nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so as you know, today's the last class and the final exam's like 1 week from today, right? I think it's in the evening, and I think I sent you all the email, and it will be a closed book exam, and there will be a page of notes available, and I sent you a copy of that so you know. And in a way, that page of notes helps to summarize what we did in the class also. It kind of covers the basic highlights. Yes. We'll be providing, yeah. So you'll have that with you, but it's closed book otherwise, you'll have that with you. So don't need to memorize what's in there. And it also gives you a study guide sort of. In general, as I've always mentioned, practice exams and homeworks are good study guides overall. Okay. Okay, and next week, I guess Monday through Wednesday, I will not be here. I'll plan to be traveling, but Thursday and Friday, I'm plan to be here. And so if you need to see me, have any questions, please send me email. And yeah, Thursday and Friday, yeah, generally I'm open. Okay. Good. So today for the last class then, I figured I'd talk about a very important conceptual point. Most of the time we're talking of all kinds of details and somehow the important conceptual points often don't come across. And the thing is that in this class, as you know, we have been talking about this bottom-up viewpoint, which is particularly useful in terms of understanding current flow in nanoscale devices. And here the simplest case, the way you think about it is, that electrons go through certain energy levels inside your channel, and they come in from here, and they get out there, and the electron that comes into this contact actually comes in at the chemical potential, and then absorbs or releases heat, exchanges heat with this contact. And then again, there is some heat exchange here. And we talked about how this is the essence of the thermoelectric effect, for example. Or if you're going through a level like this, then the electron could be dumping heat into both contacts. Now, what is nice about nanoscale devices, what I feel is, in a way, much easier to understand than large-scale devices, is that there is this clear division between what I call dynamics, namely an electron going from here to there. That's a purely dynamical process. It keeps its energy, it's like a fixed energy. It's like in mechanics, as you know, energy is conserved. When you go from one place, fixed energy. And then it's at the end that it loses energy or exchanges energies with the surrounding. And that exchange can be a fairly complicated process. That is this thing about thermodynamics, which says that, well, out here, it is always maintained in equilibrium. That's how you kind of bypass the details of this process. So the point I'm trying to make is that there is a very big difference between like what is happening here and what is happening in the contacts. And it separates the two out. And what is happening in the contacts is, in general, a fairly complicated process, which, if you wanted to describe it, could be quite difficult, you see. And in big devices, what happens is you don't have this clean separation between a channel and a contact. Everything's mixed up. In other words, as the electron's going through this device, it's exchanging energy. So the channel has both mechanics and all this energy dissipation and everything mixed into it. And that's what usually makes the understanding current flow and all a very difficult subject in general. But when you're thinking of nanoscale devices, you have this interesting division. And this is to, and what I wanted to talk about today, I guess, is a very important concept, this concept of entropy, which allows you to kind of understand or appreciate a little bit about the difference between what happens here and what happens here, in a way. So I said, well, let's take again the simplest example. Let's say we have a device with just one level. Electrons come in, go out, and let us say this is maintained at a higher temperature than that. So if both were at the same chemical potential, then because this is at a higher temperature than that, the Fermi function here would be higher than that, and we know how to calculate the current. The current is proportional to F1 minus F2, and since F1 is greater than F2, electrons would want to go from here to there. And current would want to flow. And if externally you connect it to some kind of a load, you know, let's say a light bulb, you know, some kind of a resistor, then what will happen is this current will build up a voltage across that. And when it builds up a voltage across that, this chemical potential will rise somewhat. So in a way, you're now using this as a generator. You're taking this difference between temperatures and turning it into useful work. Yeah, so this would be an example of how a thermoelectric generator works, like we were talking about. Okay. Now, an interesting thing to look at is, well, how much energy are you delivering here? Well, W, well, that is like I, the current, times this voltage difference, mu 2 minus mu 1. That's what you're really dumping, I mean, using as external work. And as we discussed, this W, this energy that you're giving here, you're getting part of it from one contact, but then wasting a little bit here. So it's like you're taking some energy from here. So I could write it as I times epsilon minus mu 1 minus epsilon minus mu 2. You know, I'm just writing it this way. And this is the part then that's like the heat you are taking, the amount of heat you are taking from contact 1. And this second part is like the heat you are dumping into contact 2. So the energy is all coming from contact 1, Q1. And if you look at it then, Q1 is equal to, you could say, Q2 plus W. So that's energy conservation. What it says is that you took this much energy from a contact, dumped this much into the other contact, and kind of got this much energy out as useful work. Yeah. Q meaning?
Like charge.
Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Yeah, yeah. I'm being sloppy on this. Yeah, that if you want work, it should be voltage times current. If you want power, actually. And if you wanted actual energy, you should multiply it by time, how long it goes on. But this is like the amount of work. Anyway, so what he pointed out was that this is energy. So if you want voltage, you should really divide it by Q. Very true. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Anyway, so you could then call this like the energy conservation law. It tells you, you know, how energy is conserved. Now, that's what is usually referred to as the first law of thermodynamics, namely energy is conserved. Now, there's another law, the one that is much less understood and much more debated, and one that if you do a Google search, you'll see endless articles discussing all aspects of it. That's the second law of thermodynamics. Now, the second law has to do with something like this. You see, when you look at this, you say, you know, I got this much heat from one contact, and I only got this much out as work because I had to dump part of it. Now, why do I have to dump any part of it? Couldn't I have used everything? I mean, it would be great if I didn't dump. You know, it would be great if I didn't have to dump this much. The point is, you are taking this out, and you're dumping that much, and only getting that much out for every electron that goes through that thing. You're wasting that much. So why am I wasting this? Couldn't I have used the whole thing? And this is where the second law says, no, you cannot. Okay? Because this is, well, there is something called this entropy, And overall, in any process, energy is conserved, but then entropy has to increase. It can remain the same or has to increase, cannot go down. And what is entropy? Well, the definition-wise, the way people think about it is that if I take any contact, let's say, and I pull a certain amount of energy out of it, then this heat energy out of it, then the entropy associated with it is this Q1 over T1. So if I'm pulling heat out of it, its entropy goes down by so much. Now, of course, I'm dumping. So if I converted all of it into work, then what would have happened is the overall entropy would have gone down. Why? Because work itself is not associated with any entropy. I mean, when you're doing useful work, that's like zero entropy, that part of it. It's this heat that is associated with entropy. And if you just did this and turned it all into work, then the thing is the entropy of the world would have gone down. And that's what second law says won't ever happen. And so the way you take care of that is by dumping a certain amount of heat into this other place so that the entropy of that contact goes up by Q2 over T2. And this whole thing has to be positive. So, since you like Q1 to be bigger than Q2, I mean, otherwise, of course, you wouldn't have got any work out of it. The only way this would work out is because this temperature is higher. So, what I mean by that is, let's say Q1 is 100 and Q2 is 50. So, if the temperatures had been equal, then, of course, overall, this would have been negative. It wouldn't have worked out. The reason it works is this temperature is bigger than that. So let's say this temperature is 100 and that temperature is, say, 25. Then you say 100 divided by 100, that's minus 1 plus 4, and so that's greater than 0. So the only way this works is if you take heat from a hot source, dump it into something cold, then you could get Q1 bigger than Q2 and actually extract energy out of it. That's how all heat engines are supposed to work. You have to take heat from a hot source and dump it into a cold source, and dump part of it into a cold source. You cannot take all the heat and just turn it into work. See? So that is essentially this second law, what it says. Now, why is there this big difference between heat and any other form of energy? Well, and this is why I guess, you know, these are things on which people, you have lots of arguments, you can see Google and all. The way I usually put it is that useful energy means when you have all your energy into 1 degree of freedom, like your car, it's moving. So it's like all your kinetic energy is in this one thing. Okay. Now, if you just, let's say your car is running and you stop it, then what will happen is the energy will gradually go out into the molecules in the road, they will start jiggling, that will get hot due to friction, and your car will come to a stop. So what happened then is you had all this energy in 1 degree of freedom, namely your car, and when it comes to a stop, all that energy has dissipated into millions of degrees of freedom in that road. And what second law says is that that's something that will naturally happen. What won't ever happen is the other way. Namely, you cannot take all this energy from millions of degrees of freedom and put it all into your car. So what won't ever happen is you can't just take heat from around you and run your car. And that's what it, and this entropy is in a way a measure of how many degrees of freedom your energy is in. That's kind of the measure of this, actually. In fact, there is a very famous equation, this S equals K log W. This is, you know, this K, you have often seen this KT in our discussion. Right? KT comes up all the time. That K is called Boltzmann constant. So sometimes people write it with a subscript B. Remind you, it's a Boltzmann constant. And the way it was defined originally was this S equals K log W, where what's W? It's like measure of how many degrees of freedom your energy is distributed in. Kind of. So when all your energy is in your car, well, the entropy is zero. There's nothing associated with it because W is one in a way. Everything's in one thing. On the other hand, when you talk about heat in something, it's like, you know, there's all this energy around us. There's all these air molecules jiggling, running around. They carry all this energy around them. Well, that energy is in many, many degrees of freedom, and then there's an associated entropy that goes with it. And this is, you know, many would argue, this is one of the most important equations that sort of relates this microscopic world to the macroscopic world, in the sense that how many degrees of freedom your energy is in, that's a microscopic concept. That's like density of states, how many states you have. And this is a macroscopic thing, entropy. In fact, as I mentioned before, in physics, there were these two branches, mechanics and thermodynamics, which developed independently. Mechanics due to Newton observing the planets, how they go around the sun, no friction involved, that's pure mechanics. And then heat engines came along, where people learned how to take heat from a hot thing, dump it into a cold thing, and run an engine. That's what thermodynamics was about. And in figuring out how to make heat engines work, they developed concepts like entropy and all that to understand experiments. No one quite had an idea of the microscopic basis for all that, where did it all come from. And there were many people who worked all through the 19th century trying to reconcile all that. And the most important person in that whole category was Boltzmann, who came up. And this equation, in a way, a kind of very important equation that relates this microscopic world to that macroscopic thing. Now, here one, you might say that, well, you know, so when we calculate currents and all that, do we really have to worry about this? Well, not exactly. I mean, the basic equations that we have gone through in this class, if you are calculating currents based on that, what you get would be in keeping with the second law of thermodynamics. So you don't have to separately worry about it. In other words, if you did it right, that's fine. But as I've often stressed, you know, calculating something and understanding something and seeing the implications, those are two different things. So for example here, how can I be sure that this second law will be satisfied? You know, because the way we calculate current, we just do F1 minus F2 and calculate a current, and then the electron takes up that much energy from here and dumps that much. But how do I know that the amount it takes up and the amount it dumps will actually obey this relation? Well, you can see that actually very, very quickly. Reason is that in order for current to flow the way I've drawn it, as you know, F1 must be, you can take this out, F1 must be greater than F2. You know, because in our equations, the current that flows is F1 minus F2. So, you might say that, well, how do I ensure F1 is greater than F2? Well, F1 depends on epsilon minus mu 1 over T1, right? Over KT1, actually. As you know, the Fermi function is equal to 1 divided by 1 plus this. Similarly, F2 depends on epsilon minus mu 2 divided by KT2. It depends on that. Now, my question is this greater or less? Which one? One of those. Because 1 divided by 1 plus exponential this must be greater than 1 divided by 1 plus exponential that. But because this is kind of in the denominator, I believe you should have to reverse that thing. So I think it's like this. That if this is less than that, then you can be sure this will be greater than that. And the current will flow the way we are assuming it. Okay, that basically says that Q1 over T1 is less than Q2 over T2. Which, of course, was the second law of thermodynamics in the first place. Okay. So the thing is, if you are calculating currents according to whatever we discussed, the second law would be satisfied at the end of the day. Now, just to illustrate this point, I thought I'd go through an interesting example. And that goes like this. You know, in this class, one of the things we discussed, I believe it was last week, this is this idea of spin valves. You know, spin valves meaning you have a device where you have two contacts, which are these two magnets. Right? So one's pointing this way, one's pointing this way. And then you have these two channels here, an up channel and a down channel. Simplest case. And as you know, the interesting spin valve results that you get, this magneto resistance and all that, is because this one, when it wants to get out here, let's say it can get out at a rate alpha, but this one can only get out at a much smaller rate beta. Why? Because up spins, here there are lots of states of up spins and you can get out there much more easily. That was the idea. Okay. Now, for this discussion, let's assume we have a perfect contact, you know, one where only one type of spin can get out. You know, this one gets out very easily, alpha, and the beta is just zero. So you cannot get out here at all. And let's say this one is anti-parallel configuration. It's turned around so that from here you get out there, but then you cannot get out here at all. This one can't get out at all. So my question is, in a structure like this, what would be the current versus voltage? What would we expect? Would we get any current in a structure like this? First question. And the answer is, you won't get any current, really. In this anti-parallel configuration, as you know, I think we went through this discussion before. If it's alpha and beta, then the current is like 2 alpha beta over alpha plus beta. And if beta is 0, you don't get anything. And physically what it means is, you see, an upspin can come in, but it can't get out anyway. And downspins can get out, but they can't come in. So it's almost like having two separate channels, and you have made one contact here and one contact there. Well, no current flows, as long as there's no connection between the channels. That's it. So you can almost think of these as two physical channels. And one has a contact on the left, the other has a contact on the right. Well, nothing happens. You can't get any current out of this. Okay. Now, one way you could get current out of this is if in this region you have a whole bunch of impurities. You know, impurities which are, let's say, random, like some are up and some are down. Now, then you can get current because an upspin electron, you know, you see, these are just static impurities sitting there. You know, things like some kind of a magnetic ion, or there are all kinds of defects that function that way. But these are like some upspin or downspin things. And what happens is, when you have an upspin electron, and if it finds one of these downspin impurities, then because of their interaction, and this is not obvious, I'm just stating it, that if you have an up electron and a down impurity, then it can flip. The down impurity can become up, and the up electron can become down. So if you had a whole bunch of impurities here, then what could happen is, an electron comes in, and then it finds one of these down impurities, you know, sort of flips it up, and in the process, the electron becomes down, and then it gets out. So in other words, these impurities, by allowing spin flip processes, can actually establish a connection between the two channels and thereby let current flow. And so if you really had a whole bunch of impurities there, you could have a current flow like this. You know, so when you apply a voltage, there would be a current flow. Electrons would come in, flip, get out. Come in, flip, get out, and so on. And experimentally, again, people see this. So when they make spin valve devices, they go to great lengths to eliminate magnetic impurities of any kind, because that kind of spoils the operation you're actually trying to do. Okay? But for the conceptual point I'm trying to make, you know, this is kind of useful, and you'll see in a minute what point I'm trying to make. It goes like this. Supposing I had a bunch of impurities, which instead of being half up and half down, which is what it normally you think would want to be, completely random, let's say instead of being half up and half down, they were all, say, one of them, you know, up or down. Let's say they were all up. Whole bunch of impurities that are all up. Now my question is, what would the current versus voltage look like? Okay. Now, if you apply a voltage so that, let's say you inject from this side, you know, usually the way we think of it is the voltage is positive on the drain side, let's say. So if you put a positive voltage here, that means you're putting a negative voltage here. So you're actually raising the chemical potential and actually injecting from here. So let's say you're injecting electrons, upspin electrons from here. Would we get any current? Well, the answer is no, because in order to flip, it needs to find a downspin. It needs to find one of these, and there aren't any. So what happens is you don't get any current on this side. But if you reverse the voltage, so you actually start injecting downspins from here, then you see there are lots of spins to flip off of. Because there's plenty of upspins here, and all the downspins can just find the upspin, flip, and there'll be current. So what would happen then is, you'd actually get more current in this direction. I mean, more because now there's actually, you know, previously it was like you had only half the spins available to flip off of. Now you got twice as many. So that's how you'd actually end up getting more current. But the point I'm trying to make is, you'd expect this thing to be this asymmetric, sort of rectifying. Because in a structure like this, electrons can only go from left, only go from right to left by flipping, but it cannot go from left to right. It's an asymmetric structure. And of course, if instead of all ups, I had all downs, then I'd just have reversed this. You know, you'd have no current this way, lots of current that way. Okay. I won't draw it here because since I don't have a color chalk, it will just get messy. All right. So let's just stick to this. Now, this is a calculation actually you could do using the models we have talked about, though the important additional thing you'd have to put in is the spin flip processes, things that take you from here to here. So you'd have to make some addition to whatever we have discussed to take that into account, but it's a fairly straightforward calculation. And at zero temperature, if you did it, you'd get a curve like that. Now, if you raise the temperature, then as you know, with temperature, everything always gets washed out. Somehow, you don't have a sharp cusp like this. Instead, what you get is something like that. So if you do this calculation at some non-zero temperature, you'd get a curve looking like that. Flips, that's the spin, the flipping of the spin. So what I mean by that is, so let's say from here you have injected an upspin electron. Now ordinarily the upspin electron, okay, it comes in, but it can't get out because it's not connected. I mean, the upspin cannot get out into this contact. So all it can do is, even if it comes in, it can just go back at some point. That's it. So no current flows ordinarily. But if I have a mechanism here that allows this electron to flip its spin and become downspin, then at that point it's able to get out. And so now current starts flowing. So the argument I'm making is, if you had an absolutely clean channel, so upspin, stay upspin, there's no way of flipping that, then you'd have zero current. If you have a channel full of impurities, half up, half down, so that ups can easily flip. And this is where I said that it's not obvious, but I made this statement that because of an interaction between electrons and impurities, usually if electron is up and impurity is down, they can interact and flip. So electron becomes down and impurity becomes up. And the reverse, if it is this way, it can interact and flip. Right? So that's the part I'm asking you to take my word for that part. And then I'm saying that, well, if it's all random, it means this can flip easily and this can flip the other way also. And then you'd get an IV characteristic that would look like this. You'd get current both ways. And now the point is, if I arrange my impurities so they're all up, then I can engineer a situation where electrons can go one way but not the other. Why? Because you come in as up, you want to flip, but they're all up, and you cannot flip unless you find a down one, because it has to be up down in order to be able to flip. And so it can't flip, and so there's no current at all. But if you inject from the other side, which means you inject a whole bunch of downs, now they have got lots of up to flip off of. And so they flip, and so you get lots of current this way. And thereby the whole thing would be asymmetric. And as I said, this is easy to incorporate into our model. I mean, if we had another homework, that would be like in homework 10 probably, yeah. Pauli principle isn't involved here though. Right? So, because for this purpose, we could almost think of it as just as ordinary particles. What I mean is, you have got a one highway that ends here, another highway that ends here, and you have to have a way of changing lanes from this to this in order to get out, almost. Right? So, Pauli principle is not involved to understand it, though. So, it's not like you cannot get in because there isn't anything there. You cannot get in because in order to flip your spin, you need to be able to interact with something. Otherwise, this is an eigenstate, you just stay there. Right? And this then allows you, by having a whole bunch of impurities that look like this, they allow this to flip and go. So you, anybody on this lane can cross over, but anybody in this lane can't come this way. So that's where the asymmetry is coming in. You can go one way, but not the other. Right? So physically, it could be the way we have done this experiment, actually. So these are actually, in real world, we have actually built devices where you have done this, where this is, say, gallium arsenide channel, and what you have in there is a bunch of manganese impurities. So manganese is a magnetic impurity, and those are static things, fixed things at various points in the channel. And the electrons are flowing in the gallium arsenide, and they can interact with that background impurity. So that's one way of doing it. And there are other various types of defects that also act as paramagnetic impurities, which could be used also, yeah.
These two disconnected lanes are like effective lanes.
Right. Because actually there's no discontinuity. In the sense, this is gallium arsenide running all the way. It's just that conceptually there's an upspin channel and a downspin channel. Like it's almost like two lanes. And the important thing is we have made contact so that one channel you can get in from here but can't get out, and the other channel you can kind of get out but not get in, right? And somewhere in between you have to cross, right? That's it. And so if you actually look at the current versus voltage at non-zero temperature, you'd come out with that. And then, as I said, this one is easy to understand, to include the temperature because of this Fermi function. There's always this spreading out. And so including the Fermi function when you do the calculation, it's this. And this looks like a minor change over that. Except that if you look carefully, you see something that should bother you, which is that at zero voltage, you actually have a current. So what we're really saying then is that in a structure like this, if I don't have any voltage, we just short circuit it, current will flow. What that means is, of course, in principle, you could be using it to light up a light bulb. You could put a load in there and current would actually flow in a structure like this. And what's, and how is it working? Well, it's sort of like this. Let's say I've got zero voltage across the whole thing. So, by itself, you have some upspin electrons, some downspin electrons. You know, it's all in equilibrium, wants to stay that way, it's up and... But then, because of these impurities, these electrons, every once in a while, they flip and go over there. And so that puts an extra upspin and kind of puts an empty spot there. And that extra guy comes out of this contact, and of course, the empty spot gets filled up from here. And so a current flows in the external circuit. And of course, ordinarily, there would also be a reverse process, one that would take these ups and turn them into downs, and that would give you a reverse thing, and there would be some noise in the external circuit, but no net current. But in this case, because this gives you a kind of unidirectional thing, where you can go this way, but you can't come the other way, that's why you actually get a DC current out, DC current in the whole thing. And so you're continually turning these things into upspins. They get out, and then a new one comes in. And again, another turn gets out, and that's how the current moves on. And you could use that in principle to light up a light bulb, as you say. You could put it up there. Okay. Now, can this go on forever? Not really, yeah. Good question, yeah. The way it works is that if I look at the Fermi function in this contact, so I've got an upspin electron, and then, so let us say this is energy, and you have one Fermi function that looks like this. This is F1. Let me write here F2. And then there is another Fermi function that's F1. And zero, and when it's in, there is no chemical potential across the whole thing, no voltage across the whole thing, it means they are both exactly the same. So the upspin channel is connected to this contact, and so it has in equilibrium with this Fermi function, and the downspin channel is in equilibrium with the other one. That's okay. Now, ordinarily, what happens is, even if you want to flip, you can't. And this is where the Pauli principle part comes in, that, okay, so an electron here, let's say, wants to flip there, but it's all completely filled. So the rate at which you flip or go from one to the other is like F1 times 1 minus F2. And the rate at which you go the other way is like F2 times 1 minus F1. And if at zero temperature, it's kind of completely blocked. Now, what happens if you raise the temperature? Well, now you see what happens is something like this. You've got an electron here, and let's say it wants to go that way. Now, there's a few electrons there, but there's lots of empty spot there too. So you can easily go that way. So right around the chemical potential, there's lots of energies where you can easily go one way and the other way also. But here, because the impurities are all up, they only take you from down to up, and not from up to down. But at zero temperature, nothing would have happened just because it's all blocked. Okay? That's about it. Okay. That's a very good point. Now, the question you could ask then is, well, does this go on forever? Well, not really. It can't go on forever because after some time, what will happen is, even if you started with all ups, every time an electron goes through, it has to flip from down to up. And so one of these ups will become down. And so after some time, what will happen is the impurities won't look like this anymore. It will look like that. Because you started with all ups, but then every time an electron goes through, it turns something down. And so after some time, it just all becomes random. So the point is you could extract some energy for it, out of it for a while. But then unless there is some external thing that is continually bringing it back to this state, this wouldn't go on forever, it would stop. But the question you could ask is that, well, you could have billions of impurities like this, which could, give you current for a while. Because every time it flips, one electron goes through, you could be extracting a significant amount of energy out of this. So you could ask that, where did all that energy come from? After all, to flip a spin doesn't involve any energy. Those are at the same energy. So the electron that's getting flipped, it's not like the energy has changed. So the fact that I'm getting some energy out of it, where did it really come from? And if you look at it, if you analyze this, it would be like, okay, here I have a Fermi function in this contact, let's say, which looks like this. mu1. And when I look on this side, let me take this off for the moment. If there was zero voltage, ordinarily, of course, you'd have exactly the same mu1. But if I'm trying to run a load, then what would happen is, because electrons are, you know, that is, you have these impurities all up. Because you are going this way and the electrons are going out this way, it will actually develop a voltage. In other words, this will get a little bit higher than that. So what will happen is, this will actually go down a little bit. That's because you have put a resistor outside. So in order for the current to flow, it will actually develop a voltage. And the electrons are going this way, so it will keep this chemical potential higher. It will drive that up. Okay. And now if you think about it, the way the thing is working at some temperature is that electrons are coming in, going through, and then giving up some energy. Actually, I think I drew this. Drew this the opposite way, sorry. It is more like this. So the thing is that inside the energy does not change, but the electron takes some energy from this contact and dumps some of it out there. And the difference is what you're getting out as light. Different is what you're getting out as useful work. So where did the energy come from? As far as first law is concerned, you know, energy has to be conserved. So where did this energy come from? So, yeah, let me draw this picture properly so you see it. Yeah. The thing is that if it is the way I am drawing it, electrons are going up this way and then flowing out that way, I believe what would happen is that the two chemical potentials will be different, and the electron when coming in from here will be, of course, absorbing some energy from here and then dumping some of it in this contact. And the difference is what will be coming out as light. So what it will be dumping will be less than what you'll be taking up. So if your electrons are coming in from here, let's say, you're taking in that much energy, but you're dumping only that much, and the difference is what you're getting out as light. So if you actually analyzed where all the energies are going, and this is relatively easy to do using the models we have discussed. Nothing fancy here. As I said, could be just another homework problem if we had time, actually. But the point I'm trying to make here is that energy-wise, this looks fine. But this is exactly what the second law normally says you cannot do. You see? Because as I kept saying before, what's important about the second law is that it says you cannot take energy from lots of degrees of freedom and turn it into useful work. Because if the energy conservation was the only issue, then we wouldn't have an energy problem. Because then why do you need oil? I mean, what I mean is you can just take energy from your surroundings and run your car. There's enough heat all around you. But what the second law says is you cannot do that. You cannot take energy from the surroundings and do useful things out of it. Right? And here you are almost seem to be doing that. You see, you are taking energy from a contact, which is in the form of heat, where entropy is associated with it. And yet, you're getting some useful work out of that. Okay? Now, why is it possible in this case? Well, that's because, of course, you started from, I mean, according to the second law, what would be wrong about it is it would look like entropy was going down. Why? Because you're taking so much heat out of it. The entropy of this went down, and this is going up, not enough, you think, because everything's at the same temperature in this discussion. Now, the reason second law, there's no problem with second law, is that you started with all ups and ended up with partly up and partly down. So if you look at the entropy of the impurities, the thing is, here everything is up. And when you have a collection of, say, 20 spins, then everyone can be up only in one way. On the other hand, it can be random in many ways. Like this 2 to the power 20 ways, essentially. It can have a random distribution. So that this configuration has a much higher entropy than that, based on this S equals K log W. So here there's only one way, so that's the entropy is 0. Here there is S equals this K log W. And that W is like 2 to the power N, so it ends up being NK log 2. So you'd say that, okay, here I see that I have the entropy of this contact has gone down, and the entropy here hasn't gone up enough. So often I'd have said overall entropy is going down, and that's not acceptable. But then the impurities increase their entropy. So that's okay. No problem with the second law. As long as the amount of energy you get out of it is not such as to violate the second law, which means you should not get any more than NKT log 2 out of it. And that, again, one can actually show that if you start them out all this way and you look, calculate actually what's the maximum energy you'd get out of it, you'd find that the answer is always less than NKT log 2. But the important point I'm trying to make here is usually the way you think of energy is that something that gives you energy. And the point, and the thing is, here, you're actually just taking an energy from the surroundings and turning it into useful work. And what is allowing you to do that is the fact that you started from a particularly low entropy situation. Now, there's not too much of a mystery here, by the way. If you think about why is it that it goes this way and doesn't go the other way. So, for example, if you started with something that is completely random, it would never go this way and give you any energy out of it. It would never work the other way. There's this one-wayness of the whole thing. And the reason is, in a way, relatively simple. I mean, there's only one state here of this type, W equals 1. And this is the one with W equals 2 to the power 20. So you have one way of being here. From here, you can spread out into all of this. But from all, if you are distributed all over, you'll never come back to 1. That's basically it, you see. And this is what, I guess, loosely you could call something like an entropic force. I mean, lots of things in life are actually driven not by mechanical forces, but just by entropic things like this. You know, the simplest example of that is, why is it that heat always flows from a hot object? I guess we're running out of time, so I won't go into that. Let me just state it as, one thing we know in real life is heat always flows from hot things to cold things. Now, why is it never goes from cold to hot? Now, what you can show is that when it goes from hot to cold, again, entropy would increase. But if it had actually gone from cold to hot, entropy would have gone down, which is the way you would understand why it doesn't go the other way. And the point I'm trying to make here is that in real life, there are lots of things that are not driven by Newtonian forces or, you know, mechanical things that we understand in the usual way, but are driven by these thermodynamic forces, which just comes from this law of numbers, this entropy. This whole thing, the same basic thing, that takes you from here to here, but never from here to there, whatever. And what is hard is, you see, when you are trying to describe current flow on this scale, we have Schrodinger equation, let's say. That is mechanics. It's quantum mechanics, but the point is, at the end of the day, it's still mechanics. It's the replacement for Newton's law. But it's still mechanics. It describes, you know, how electrons flow from one point to another without changing their energy. But then you also have to include these thermodynamic things, these entropic things that happen at the end in the contacts. And this is where in nanoscale devices, we kind of almost gloss over that very difficult issues. And we just say, well, these two ends are always maintained in thermodynamic equilibrium. And that's how, you know, we have a F1 and a F2, and that takes care of things quite well. Okay? But what really makes it conceptually relatively simple is, then as far as electrons going from here to here, it's pure mechanics. And then there is the entropic stuff at the end. Whereas in big conductors, all that is mixed up. And this entropic term is what is extremely difficult to get into a pure mechanical description. So for example, let me just end with this one simple thing, and that is, in a hydrogen atom, as you know, there is a 1s level, and then there is this 2s and 2p levels. And how did people find out about these levels? Well, because when you put an electron there, it wants to come down and emit light. And 100 years ago, people had measured the frequency of that light. And based on that, they figured out what the energy difference has been. It is. But the point is, why does it come down this way? And once it's down here, it never goes up. Why is that? And the point is, that's not something that will come out of Schrodinger equation. No matter how long you fool around with it, it's like, if it takes you down, it will also take you up. This is an entropic issue. The whole idea is that when an electron goes down, it is giving up energy to the surroundings. And when you look at the surroundings energy, and this is like the density of states of the surroundings. If the electron is here, let's say surroundings have a certain energy. And when the electron comes down, because the electron has lost energy, the surroundings have to go up in energy. And the surroundings always have a much higher density of states or entropy associated with that. And so it is all, when you are trying to come down, you have lots of states to go down to, like 10,000 states, let's say. But when you're trying to go up, there's only one or two states. And that is kind of what makes it easier to come down than to go up. But that's not something that comes out of Schrodinger equation in any simple way, that part. And the only way you can do it is, again, by invoking contacts of some kind and putting it in. And this is what conceptually makes it so hard, this subject overall. And, you know, and often it's not clear exactly, you know, how people gloss over these issues and how exactly you take care of them, so that what you calculate is, you know, doesn't violate the second law and entropy and all that. Okay, so with that, let me stop and thank you all for your attention, and we'll see you next Friday.